Good morning. It's Monday, August 27, 2018. This is Upfront. I'm Brian Edwards-Tiekert.
And I am Gina Madrid. And on today's show, Crime and Punishment, a new controversial documentary directed by Steve Main. It chronicles 12 whistleblowers, New York police officers exposing corruption, discriminatory policing practices, and illegal use of arrests and quotas.
But first, Mitch Jeserich is joining us for Mondays with Mitch to go through all the latest developments in Trumpland. Who is cooperating, who has received immunity, and what that might mean about the scandals ahead. In the second hour of our program, we're going to do a deep dive on what it means that ICE is now pulled out of Contra Costa's jail system, what's happened to all the people who were being held there, and we'll look into what the recent resignation of the independent police auditor in San Jose bodes for that city. All that and a whole lot more coming up next.
After the news.
I'm Max Pringle with these headlines. Plans to memorialize Senator John McCain are beginning to take shape. Two former presidents are expected to speak at his service, and he will lie in state in both the nation's capital and the state capital in Arizona as part of a cross-country funeral procession ending with his burial at the U.S. Naval Academy. McCain had long feuded with President Trump, and two White House officials said McCain's family had asked before the senator's death that Trump not attend the funeral services. However, Vice President Pence is likely to attend. A day after McCain died of brain cancer at 81, his family, friends, and congressional and state leaders were working out details of the farewell to the decorated Vietnam War hero, prisoner of war, and six-term senator. Former presidential election rivals, Presidents George W. Bush and Barack Obama, are among those expected to speak at McCain's funeral. McCain admonished his colleagues about partisan division and where it's leading the country soon after returning to the Senate after cancer surgery.
I hope we can again rely on humility, on our need to cooperate, on our dependence on each other, to learn how to trust each other again, and by so doing better, serve the people who elected us. Stop listening to the bombastic loudmouths on the radio and television and the internet. To hell with them.
Arizona Governor Doug Ducey will name McCain's successor to serve until a special election for his seat in 2020. McCain was a pilot in the Vietnam War. He was shot down over Vietnam and held as a prisoner of war under harsh conditions for more than 5 years. He refused to be released before those who had been captured before him. He went on to win a seat in the House and in 1986 the Senate, where he served for the remainder of his life. Authorities say a gunman opened fire at an online video game tournament in Florida, killing two people before fatally shooting himself, as a live stream of the event appeared to capture gunfire, shouts, and screams. Jacksonville Sheriff Mike Williams said at a news conference after the rampage Sunday afternoon that nine other people were wounded by gunfire and two others had been hurt in the chaos as people sought to flee. He said authorities believe 24-year-old David Katz of Baltimore carried out the attack with at least one handgun at the Jacksonville Landing, a complex of eateries and shops on the St. Johns River in the north of the Florida city.
The single suspect in this case is a white male, and this is pending confirmation, but we believe the suspect to be 24-year-old David Katz from Baltimore, Maryland. And the FBI is assisting us with that leg of the investigation in Baltimore.
Williams said the suspect died of a self-inflicted gunshot, and authorities were still confirming his identity. He says he has no immediate motive for the shooting. Pope Francis faced a lukewarm reception and scattered protests Saturday on his trip to Ireland, with even his vow to rid the church of the scourge of sexual abuse and his outrage of those repugnant crimes dismissed as a disappointment by some of Ireland's wounded victims. But others who met with him in private left heartened that he would respond to their plight, including two of the thousands of children who were forcibly put up for adoption for the shame of having been born to unwed mothers. The abuse scandal, which has exploded anew in the United States, but has convulsed Ireland since the 90s with revelations of unfathomable violence and humiliation against women and children, took center stage on the first day of Francis's two-day trip. The visit was originally intended to celebrate Catholic families. Francis responded to the outcry by vowing to end sex abuse and cover-up during a speech to Irish government authorities at Dublin Castle. He said, quote, "The failure of ecclesiastical authorities, bishops, religious superiors, priests, and others to adequately address these repugnant crimes has rightly given rise to outrage and remains a source of pain and shame for the Catholic community." He cited measures taken by his predecessor, Pope Benedict, to respond to the crisis. But while Benedict is credited with cracking down on abusers, he never acknowledged the Vatican's role in fueling a culture of cover-up or sanctioned bishops for failing to protect their flocks from predatory priests. Hawaii emerged this weekend from the threat of a potentially devastating hurricane after historic amounts of rain forced evacuations on some islands, but damage appeared less than feared. Tropical Storm Lane, once known as Hurricane Lane, began to break apart as it veered west into the Pacific Ocean, leaving behind sighs of relief and plenty of cleanup, especially on the Big Island, where rainfall totals approached 4 feet. No storm-related deaths have been reported, though Big Island authorities said they plucked families from floodwaters and landslides closed roads. The National Weather Service canceled all storm warnings for the state several hours after shopkeepers in Honolulu's tourist-heavy areas already started taking down plywood meant to protect windows in the storm. Preliminary figures from the Weather Service show that Lane dropped the fourth highest amount of rain for a hurricane to hit the U.S. since 1950. Hurricane Harvey, which devastated Texas a year ago, topped the list. California lawmakers are considering possible legislative fixes to prevent a repeat of a recent incident where communications giant Verizon slowed internet service to a Bay Area fire department battling the Mendocino Complex fire, the state's largest ever wildfire. And as Jody Strait reports, the Santa Clara County Fire Department is suing the company over the issue.
Santa Clara Fire Department Chief Tony Bowden told lawmakers that Verizon endangered public safety in its attempt to convert his agency to a higher-cost data plan.
Unfortunately, over the last few months, we experienced a situation where our connectivity was throttled by a provider. This occurred despite several conversations with our account representative that the devices were providing essential services. I found the situation personally to be unacceptable.
The furor over Verizon's actions during the Mendocino Complex fire came as California lawmakers are debating whether to adopt a state net neutrality plan after the Federal Communications Commission overturned the Obama-era rules. Verizon insisted the slowdown was not related to net neutrality and rather due to a human error within the company. For KPFA Radio in Berkeley, I'm Jody Strait.
Staffers, lawmakers, and lobbyists say the party scene in California's capital has mellowed since the Me Too reckoning hit Sacramento last fall, prompting the resignations of three lawmakers and pledges of change. But several reports of bad behavior, sexual and otherwise, have recently surfaced. Republican Senator Joel Anderson was kicked out of a bar earlier this month for allegedly threatening to hit a female lobbyist, and a union president was accused of shoving a lawmaker earlier in the month. Both incidents resulted in formal complaints to the legislature. Observers say the coming weeks will provide a test of whether cultural change has truly taken root as the current legislative session ends and election season kicks into high gear. Partly cloudy today in the San Francisco Bay Area, highs in the 60s and 70s, overnight lows in the 50s. In the central San Joaquin Valley, partly cloudy with highs in the 90s. I'm Max Pringle. News returns at 7:30 on KPFA.
It is 7:09 in the morning. You're listening to Upfront. I'm Brian Edwards-Tiekert.
And I am Gina Madrid.
And we're joined in studio for Mondays with Mitch by social media sensation, Mitchell Jezerich.
Oh, wow. I sound like my mom. Brian Edwards-Tiekert, Gina Madrid, buenos dias.
Buenos dias.
Buenos dias. You wrote up your personal experiences with Senator John McCain from your 3 years as a Capitol correspondent for this radio network.
Yeah. So, you know, it's interesting. John McCain is somebody that I interviewed a lot when I was on the Hill. John McCain and Jeff Sessions. Those are the two guys I could get to with frequency. And, you know, John McCain's passing is is interesting. One, I think he is one of the last few. He's not the last one, but the few remaining senators that come from an era. They didn't create this era, but they got into the Senate during this era, in which you still had a large part, an effort towards bipartisanship. And so you see that through McCain's time in office. He had the McCain-Feingold bill law that was, you know, overturned. But that bill that dealt with money in politics. Then you had, what, 12 years ago, he teaming up with Senator Ted Kennedy for an immigration reform measure. Now, half the that measure split the immigrant rights community at the time. But if you compare to where the Republican Party is today compared to where it was in 2007, there's a really big difference there. And of course, he was somebody who voted against repealing Obamacare last year. So, you know, these words that this man was a maverick, that he marched to his own tune, you know, sometimes it was true. But I found him more often to be somebody who actually went along with the game, especially the game of empire, and would be fiercely critical when something would go wrong within those parameters, but always supporting the general effort, including the invasion and the war in Iraq, and including his stance on the treatment and what we did with so-called enemy combatants, people that were captured by the United States in the war on terrorism. And I interviewed John McCain quite frequently about this very issue. In fact, the very first time I ever talked to him in 2003, I asked him, as a former prisoner of war himself, who was tortured, if he was concerned about keeping people at Guantanamo Bay as so-called enemy combatants. And enemy combatants is an important designation because they weren't considered prisoners of war. Hence, they weren't, by the United States anyways, given protection of the Geneva Accords, which laid out post-World War II, basically the international norms on how to treat prisoners of war. And so I asked him, as a former prisoner of war himself, are you concerned about these people not being afforded the international protections that you think maybe they may want to have? And he said no. We went into back and forward for a little while about it until eventually he just yelled at me, you know, you and I clearly disagree. Let's leave it at that. Well, that's how many of our interviews over the next 3 years actually would end. but I think it was really too bad, actually, his position on the issue of enemy combatants and keeping people at that designation. Because I do believe right from that, when the Bush administration decided that they were going to create this extrajudicial category for holding these people, that opened the door to what would eventually come with torture and torturing these people. And to John McCain's credit, he held hearings when these stories came to light. Now, first time I interviewed him, we didn't hear those stories yet. It would be like a year or two later that would happen. He did hold hearings. He held, and I remember him, you know, being very tough on people who come testify at those hearings, including Donald Rumsfeld, former Secretary of Defense. He would sponsor legislation to curb, if not end, so-called enhanced interrogation techniques. And those were good, but at the same time, he never did. And I thought with his moral stature, right, somebody like John McCain could come out to the world even after 9/11 and say something to the effect of, look, I was a prisoner of war in Vietnam for a number of years. I was tortured while I was there. It's important to me that we as a nation remember who we are, and that it's important to me that torture should never, ever happen. John McCain had that stature where he could have done that, and I think probably could have got his way if he chose to, but he didn't. He accepted this idea of enemy combatant. And here we are 17 years later, and there are still detainees being held at Guantanamo Bay who've never been tried. And now we have a president who, you know, at least campaigned about filling Guantanamo Bay back up. So for me, that's something that I will always very much remember about John McCain. I think that was an important time, and I think he could have made a real difference. And with that, he did not.
Yeah, it was always hard to read him, his reputation as a maverick, whether it was about him having some principles that he would not subsume to the Republican Party, or just being kind of erratic and unpredictable. because he did toe the party line on a lot of votes. Right, he lined up behind the party for every push to war, as you mentioned. He voted for that giant tax giveaway to plutocrats most recently. On a couple occasions, took heroic stances for clean government. McCain-Feingold was one of them, and another seemed to be, completely unconcerned with legalized corruption in the American governance system. It's really hard to put a finger on what the Maverick reputation signified in terms of his approach to lawmaking.
Yeah, that's why I think I said that he's somebody that usually supported the overall program, overall goal of the Republican Party, who would be fiercely critical of it going wrong and when it messed up. And that's especially what he did with, say, the Iraq War and the aftermath of that war. I interviewed him a lot over the years. I remember he was the chair of a subcommittee on the appropriations that dealt with funding for the Pentagon. And his committee was purchasing cluster bombs for the military. And cluster bombs were one of the largest killers of civilians in Iraq and Afghanistan. And their human rights groups weren't even asking that they didn't buy these cluster bombs, just that they buy better ones. Because what happens with cluster bombs is you have one missile that goes out. When it explodes, a bunch of other bombs come out from it and then explode, have a secondary explosion. But many of them never explode. They're duds, and at least initially. And what eventually happens is somebody accidentally steps on it and they're maimed or killed, or a child comes and they play with it and off goes an arm, or they're killed as well. And that's how cluster bombs usually work. And human rights groups at the time weren't even asking that they don't buy cluster bombs, just buy a more expensive kind that has a less dud rate so you didn't have as many civilian casualties. And I remember going to ask John McCain about that. And, he said, no, we're not going to do that. We're going to keep to this. And I laid out the facts to him that I had discovered. And his response to me was, well, I don't know anything about that. And once again, clearly you and I disagree. So that's the end of our conversation. John McCain, for me, is somebody, because I covered him so much, I do feel, I'm not 81 years old, but I'm certainly not 30 anymore as I was when I first started covering him. And we had a lot of, he liked my predecessor and my successor on the Hill quite a bit, told dirty jokes to my predecessor. My successor, he did FaceTime with her children. But me, he never looked too happy when he saw me towards him. And that's not to say that they weren't tough reporters. They were. They were very good reporters. And, for me, when I would approach him, especially that first time about Guantanamo Bay, I wasn't so sure. I've asked those type of questions before at the state capitol here in Sacramento when I was a legislative correspondent here. But John McCain was a whole new ballgame. I wasn't sure when I went home that night whether or not I would have been extraordinarily renditioned and sent to one of Gina Haspel's House of Terrors in Thailand or something. So, but I will say the last time I saw him was in 2008, and I went to Washington, D.C. for about a month to begin a special pilot program called Letters from Washington to cover the first 100 days of the Obama administration. And this is what would turn into Letters in Politics. And while there, John McCain, remember, he ran for president the previous year. He saw me and he looked tired and beat up, very much the way that I remember seeing John Kerry in 2005 after that presidential election. And when he saw me, he turned towards me, he shook my hand, he told me it was good to see me again. And I remember I just thought to myself, wow, running for president must really suck.
Particularly if you win.
Yeah. Well, he lost.
As we have learned, one consequence of running for president can be criminal indictments against all of your business associates and potentially family members. We had intended this morning to do kind of a roundup of where things stand in Trumpland, because the developments have been coming fast and furious out of the now various and varied federal and state level probes into the doing of Donald Trump, the Trump Organization, and the Trump Foundation. I guess we should do a very quick roundup. So news broke late last week that this CFO, chief financial officer of the Trump Organization, the one who knows where all the money came from and all it went, where it all went, Alan Weisselberg, has been granted immunity from prosecution in exchange for testifying to the Mueller probe. Also, the chief executive officer of American Media, Inc., which is what publishes the National Enquirer, David Pecker, has been granted immunity. And this is very interesting because of that publication's role in buying the rights to stories like the Stormy Daniels affair story that reflected unfavorably on Donald Trump and then killing them rather than publishing them. The Trump Tower doorman, Dino Sanjudin.
Who else, Brian?
Who had had his story about an affair that Donald Trump purportedly had with a housekeeper that resulted in an out-of-wedlock child, purchased by the National Enquirer, has now apparently been released from that agreement or given permission to publish the text of that agreement. It was signed in late 2015.
How about the dog walker, Brian? Did they get to...
The dog walker has not been indicted yet, as far as I can tell, but we have dog walker watch. It's hard to tell how much of this is new developments and how much of this is us finding out more about the work that led up to the guilty plea from Michael Cohen. It looks like some of this cooperation has been happening for some time. But the revelations in particular about David Pecker, the National Enquirer CEO, paint such a kind of shocking image of the corrupt machinery built up around the Donald Trump phenomenon. There's basically three narratives, three slightly divergent narratives on what he was doing and why. So the first is he's pals with Donald Trump, which he is. And just as a, you know, we're friends kind of thing, he would purchase up any stories that his reporters sniffed out that would reflect negatively on Donald Trump. Just kill him. Keep him in the safe. The second is that this is more like a business relationship, almost like Donald Trump had him on a retainer to hoover up these stories and then sell the rights to Donald Trump so they could be killed. Because obviously, if Donald Trump were the one approaching you, asking you to buy the rights to the story about how you had an affair with him, it might not go over as well. You would know he didn't intend to bring it to the light of day. You might ask for more money. And the third one makes it sound, the third narrative makes it sound more like an extortion racket, like Pecker would buy these stories, they would sit in his safe, and then that's leverage over people he had the stories on. In any case,
it could be all three.
It could be all three,
yeah.
Or some combination of all three. It raises kind of two really important questions, like how many things are in the safe that prosecutors and investigators are now going to have access to, and how many other people in elite New York real estate and organized crime circles does he have stories on that prosecutors will be able to get into now? So I don't know what the next shoe is, but it's going to be really interesting to see it drop.
What about the legality of all this? And is it press freedom, Brian, to be able to say we have the, for AMI anyways, mm-hmm. and that runs the National Enquirer, is it press freedom to say, look, we have the right to publish and we have the right not to publish?
Mm-hmm. Yes. I don't think that's what's being litigated, though. I mean, I'm
just talking about the practice of itself, of buying a story that could mm-hmm. be harmful for a candidate. And then I guess that can, I mean, does that get tied up into campaign finance laws? Or is it a press issue?
So I think that gets into the question of whether or not there was a business relationship with Donald Trump, right? Or whether it was just a question of them being kind of friendly to each other. Or, you know, there's when the Stormy Daniels story, sorry, not Stormy Daniels, Karen McDougal, I'm losing track of all the people who had affairs with Donald Trump.
Some people say they're
the Playboy centerfold. Yeah. Her story was bought by the National Enquirer and killed by the National Enquirer about her purported affair with Donald Trump. You know, when that story was bought, he was not a national presidential candidate. And they could have credibly decided, yeah, this story might be worth something in a few years, but it's not worth running now. You know, let's just keep it in the safe. You know, it could come down to editorial judgment. But, you know, I don't know. The National Enquirer is a gossip tabloid. It doesn't claim to be a fierce defender of the public interest through ruthless reporting. They have gotten a lot of stories broken in their pages that turned out to be right over the years. They've gotten several stories wrong in pretty massive ways. And, you know, the bigger issue is in the course of doing what they did, were they suppressing evidence of crimes?
And just thinking aloud here, that tape that we have that Michael Cohen recorded mm-hmm. of himself with Donald Trump and talking about paying that $130,000 concerning, I think this one was concerning Stormy Daniels, mm-hmm. That also involved AMI. I think it was to pay Bob Pecker mm-hmm. That money. And we know that from last week's reporting that Cohen has said that he pleaded guilty of committing a crime and implicated Donald Trump in doing that as well as being directed by Donald Trump, which to me brings up another interesting issue. And we heard once again, and this wasn't new, but from Democrats last week saying that they're still not interested in pursuing impeachment of Donald Trump over this. And I think on one hand, maybe it's, you know, I think you could easily make the argument this is a good electoral strategy. Things are looking good for you heading into November, especially with these most latest scandals. And I don't think that John McCain's death is going to help Republicans very much as well, at least if they're supporting Donald Trump, because John McCain has specifically said he did not want Donald Trump at his funeral, while George Bush and Barack Obama will be giving eulogies at the funeral. So that doesn't look good as the nation, you know, has this public display of mourning over him. But all that said, I think it's really regrettable that they would just so publicly take impeachment off the table, because if a president commits a crime, your really only avenue for to address that is through the impeachment process. Mm-hmm. And I really think it's, to me, it's not even about if you can convict the president, because if you impeach the president in the House and it goes to a trial in the Senate, I, for one, would just like to see a trial. I would like to see all the evidence laid out and for people to argue for it, people to argue against it, and just lay it out, because yep. right now there's so many different narratives of what's going on.
So I think it's worth drawing a distinction between taking impeachment off the table and not campaigning on impeachment. Axios was just out with a spreadsheet of 100 issues that congressional Democrats have requested information on, all of which could be their own investigations into the doings of the Trump administration, that would have the force of subpoena power behind them if Democrats took a majority in the House. And I think partly what you're seeing is a political calculus. If you look at Donald Trump's approval ratings over the course of the nearly 2 years that he's been in the presidency, they have dipped the hardest when the national conversation has been dominated by issues of substantive policy. The push by Republicans in Congress to take away health care benefits under the Affordable Care Act, the push, successful, by Republicans in Congress to give massive tax breaks to wealthy people and corporations. And when the national conversation has been consumed by the varied and various scandals confronting Donald Trump personally, his approval numbers tend to bounce back up. So if, and I'm reading a little bit into the rhetoric, but if Democratic strategy makers are saying, look, don't run on impeachment, let's not get stuck in a conversation about impeachment right now. Let's talk about people's health care. Let's talk about their access. Let's talk about pursuing corruption in government. You know, if you're Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, talk about free college. Whatever it is, talk about what you're going to do for people, not what you're going to do to Donald Trump. That's a strategic decision that makes a lot of sense to me and does not preclude nonstop, relentless hearings with subpoena power behind them in the House once Democrats take the majority, any of which could, in swift order, lead to an impeachment proceeding.
Yeah. No. And it probably is good politics. I think they're saying more than we're just not discussing it right now. I think from the leadership, we are getting more of a sense that they're saying it. And they could change course on all that afterwards, obviously. But I don't know if they will, because then they'll be looking at the 2020 election and they'll be looking at the possibilities of winning the White House as well. And maybe that's the best way to go about all of this. But again, impeachment is this one tool that Congress has in order to keep a president, well, not the only tool, but a major tool of keeping a president accountable towards any potential criminal activity.
But I think 67 votes in the Senate. I mean, that's what it takes to
remove a president. Yeah, so have a trial.
Well, so, I mean, I think the thing is,
I'm not even saying the goal should be to get him out of office.
Right. Those Republicans in the Senate are not going to defect unless Donald Trump's approval among the Republican base has dipped low enough that he is a liability rather than an asset to Republicans in the Senate who are standing for re-election. That has not happened yet. Over the course of long drawn out hearings in the House, if they shift the terms of national discussion about politics, maybe that does happen. But it seems like that would be a prerequisite for an impeachment proceeding that would be anything other than theater, that would actually remove the president from office.
Yeah, I mean, you have to have a trial and then people vote and you may not get the 2/3 you need. But I think what will eventually be needed, and I'm not saying right this very minute, I mean, you don't even have the Mueller report out yet, but I think eventually what's going to be needed is some type of closure. And I think that's one way to do it, by actually having a public trial in the Senate.
Mm. Yep. We'll see. That takes us to 7:31 in the morning. The program's up front. My name's Brian Edwards-Tiekert.
And I am Gina Madrid.
What do we got coming up, Gina?
We will go deep in conversation with the director of Crime and Punishment, a new documentary that chronicles 12 whistleblowers, New York police officers exposing corruption and discriminatory policing practices.
That is in just a few minutes after the news.
I'm Max Pringle with these headlines. Plans to memorialize Senator John McCain are beginning to take shape. Two former presidents are expected to speak at his service, and he will lie in state in both the nation's capital and the state capitol rotunda in Arizona as part of a cross-country funeral procession ending with his burial at the U.S. Naval Academy. McCain had long feuded with President Trump, and two White House officials said McCain's family had asked before the senator's death that Trump not attend the funeral services. However, Vice President Mike Pence is likely to attend. A day after McCain died of brain cancer at 81, his family, friends, and congressional and state leaders were working out details of the farewell to the decorated Vietnam War hero, prisoner of war, and six-term senator. Former presidential election rivals, Presidents George W. Bush and Barack Obama, are among those expected to speak at McCain's funeral. Arizona Governor Doug Ducey will name McCain's successor to serve until a special election for his seat in 2020. Pope Francis faced a lukewarm reception and scattered protests Saturday on his trip to Ireland, with even his vow to rid the church of the scourge of sexual abuse and his outrage of the repugnant crimes dismissed as a disappointment by some of Ireland's wounded victims. But others who met with him in private left heartened that he would respond to their plight, including two of the thousands of children who were forcibly put up for adoption for the shame of having been born to unwed mothers. The abuse scandal, which has exploded anew in the U.S., but has convulsed Ireland since the 1990s with revelations of unfathomable violence and humiliation against women and children, took center stage on the first day of Francis's two-day trip. The visit was originally intended to celebrate Catholic families. Francis responded to the outcry by vowing to end sex abuse and cover-up during a speech to Irish government authorities at Dublin Castle.
We ask forgiveness for the abuses in Ireland, abuses of power, conscience, and sexual abuse perpetrated by members with roles of responsibility in the church. In a special way, we ask for pardon for all the abuses committed in various types of institutions run by male or female religious figures and by other members of the church.
Francis cited measures taken by his predecessor, Pope Benedict, to respond to the crisis, but while Benedict is credited with cracking down on abusers, he never acknowledged the Vatican's role in fueling a culture of cover-up or sanctioned bishops for failing to protect their flocks from predator priests. A U.S. strike over the weekend killed a senior Islamic State commander in eastern Afghanistan. That, according to Afghan and U.S. officials today, the strike in Nangarhar province killed Abu Sayyid Orakzai, a senior leader in the extremist group. Afghan officials said the operation showed the government's determination to fight terrorism. U.S. Lieutenant Colonel Martin O'Donnell, the spokesman for the U.S. forces in Afghanistan, said American forces launched a counterterrorism strike in eastern Afghanistan on a Saturday that targeted a senior leader of the organization. He did not provide further details. Orakzai, who also was known as Abu Saad Arhabi, was the head of the Islamic State group in Afghanistan, according to a government official who spoke on condition of anonymity. Partly cloudy today in the San Francisco Bay Area. Highs in the 60s and 70s. Overnight lows in the 50s. In the central San Joaquin Valley, partly cloudy with highs in the 90s. I'm Max Pringle. News returns at 8 on KPFA.
You are listening to Upfront. I am Gina Madrid. Today we'll talk about a documentary that goes deep behind the scenes to undercover and expose discriminatory policing practices, intimidation, and corruption within the New York Police Department. It chronicles a band of minority whistleblowers, officers known as the New York PD 12, and the efforts of cop-turned-private investigator as they seek to expose the illegal use of arrests and summons quotas. Crime and Punishment has received already a special jury award at the 2018 Sundance Film Festival. This will be showing on August 31st at the Roxy Theater in San Francisco. Thanks. Today, I am happy to be speaking with the person behind Crime and Punishment documentary, Steve Main, director, producer, and cinematographer, editor. He's an Emmy-nominated Brooklyn-based filmmaker. His feature documentary, High Tech Low Life, was broadcast nationally on PBS, award-winning series POV. He has directed films for the New York Times, Time Magazine, The Nation, and Field of Vision. But today, we will talk about his new film, Crime Plus Punishment, co-produced with Laura Potras. Welcome. How are you, Steve?
I'm good, Gina. Thank you so much for having me. This is really a pleasure and an honor.
What inspired you to make this documentary?
What inspired me to make this film was the fact that after having made three other projects about policing in New York City, mm-hmm. we were still quite unsettled by the idea that there were so many problems that were going unresolved. Mm-hmm. And yet, on some level, being openly acknowledged by the department and the city. And so an opportunity was presented to me to create a very long-form piece after having made several shorts and a one-hour film. Mm. In those previous projects, right. we had access to a couple of NYPD cops who showed up anonymously with their names redacted and their faces silhouetted. And they shared a lot of insight as to some of the struggles they were experiencing and the retaliation they were receiving for not complying with the quota in New York City. And the quota is the pressure for officers to meet a certain number of arrests and summonses every month. Mm-hmm. When 2014 rolled around, which was supposed to be a reform year, Mayor Bill de Blasio came in as a reform candidate. He brought in Commissioner William Bratton. Everybody thought that things were going to change. Mm. We saw the death of Eric Garner in Staten Island. We saw a series of really horrific cell phone citizen captured video of abusive policing practices. And the officers that we had initially filmed with had started to decide, as this is all starting to unfold, that they wanted to go more public and that they needed to share their story. and actually, you know, share their identities. And mm-hmm. so, you know, I asked them if they wanted to be part of a long form, more character based project that would track their evolution as they tried to push back against the department and expose some of these harmful practices. And they did not hesitate at all. And that led to so many other officers coming together to join what would become this historic class action lawsuit against the NYPD for violation of the 2010 quota law, which prohibits quota-based policing mm-hmm. in the workplace, and also a violation of the 14th Amendment Equal Protections Act.
And so you were the one who approached them to see if they wanted to work. How did you find out exactly that they were following a lawsuit, and how, you know, everybody, all these cops started coming together? Like, were you the one who approached them? How did that start?
Sure. So initially, an attorney involved in the 2013 federal hearing on stop and frisk reached out, and my producer, Ross Tuttle, was able to make first contact with one of the officers who was involved in that lawsuit. That led to a second officer. And then from there, as the years wore on, you know, as the word was spreading that cops were starting to come forward more. And it just kind of uncorked what became then a groundswell of officers who were coming coming out and wanting to participate in, you know, what was a rumor of a possible lawsuit that was being put together. And yeah, so, you know, one of the really unexpected things was that as those first two officers turned into three and five and seven, you know, it led us to then what became their legal representation for the class action. And through that class action lawsuit, we actually met the private investigator, Manuel Gomez, who was working on both this lawsuit and as well as canvassing the neighborhoods to find young men who had been the target of the quota, young men and women, that is, in disenfranchised communities.
And he's a former police officer, correct?
Exactly. And he was former NYPD and had trouble with some of the policing practices during that time as well. You know, was labeled a troublemaker, which is kind of like, you know, shorthand for cops who refuse to sort of comply or drink the Kool-Aid as they describe
it.
And so fast forward to the time where he's now become a private investigator, and it was staggering. You know, I spent a lot of time with him filming as he talked to countless young men and women who were being falsely arrested multiple times, 5, 6, 7, 8, 12 times, fabricated charges.
Yeah, for no reason.
For no reason, because there is no penalty for a falsified arrest. And in fact, what was happening was some of these officers were being promoted because they were exceeding the quota as a result. And they were performing, quote unquote, well and above, you know, the expectation.
Who is your target audience? Is it police officers? Is it the public? Who are you trying to reach with this film?
Both. And, you know, to what you just said, I think that's a really important point also, that it is about the hard choices that officers have to make when they are subjected to the kinds of pressures that force them to make hard decisions because of the quota expectation. What we're trying to demonstrate in the film by tracking these officers for over 4 years was that this is about policy that exists in the department, particularly CompStat, which is the foundation for the quota policy, which is used as a tool to drive up arrests and summons numbers. there's a very big issue and question and discussion that has not been addressed fully in New York City, which is why do we have such a harmful policing policy when not just the community, but also cops are on the receiving end and are being hurt by this. Good cops who joined the force because they truly believe that they could do something good for the community and actually protect and serve.
What was the process like in your interaction with the cops featured on the film?
It was exhausting. Mm-hmm. I had filmed, I think, about over 1,000 hours over 4 years. You know, it was being on call constantly, waiting and being ready to run out the door at any hour because something was happening. You know, it was became very clear to me that this idea of bearing witness was sort of at the core of this the film, that people, I felt, would not believe the claims of these individuals if we just interviewed them. Mm-hmm. We had to be there to see firsthand what it looks like and feels like to be retaliated against by your supervisor.
Are these cops still working within the police department?
Three of them have retired.
Okay.
And the remaining officers are all on the job, and they, when I recently asked a lot of them, they all say that, you know, it's still business as usual. Their their careers are still very, you know, compromised, and they are being retaliated against.
Are they going to continue to try to fight against the police department and their practices?
Yeah, they all are deeply committed to trying to improve policing and believe that as people who have, individuals who have worked within law enforcement and care about both community safety and the protection of people's, you know, civil rights and liberties, that this is an issue that is much bigger than each of them individually. That being said, you know, it was a great disappointment for the case to be dismissed, and their attorneys are going to file another appeal. There are individual cases that will move forward. Some may not. And those individual retaliation claims, you know, will be important to track in the future. But overall, what is becoming clear about their efforts, and in a way, the sort of like the big picture for the story that the film captures, is that we need to look more closely at why we don't have an independent investigative body in New York City and in most cities when it comes to policing. We're not trying to say that this is this commissioner's fault, right? Or that we're, but we are trying to create more accountability by the department and the city, because at every moment, the commissioner, the mayor, whoever happens to be in position of the, in this position of power, has the ability to change the course of and the direction of history. Really, I mean, to be the one that finally actually addresses what has been so harmful. I mean, I don't think that a lot of these people who might even be listening to this interview, like, perhaps fully feel and can relate to the impact that these kinds of, like, very aggressive negative interactions with the minority communities has had. I mean, this destroys lives.
Yeah, and communities.
You know, there is so much negative press that has been orchestrated around Pedro Hernandez, for example, you know, arrested, falsified 7-8 times for crimes he did not commit, and he will be exonerated for every single one of those falsified arrests. And yet, in the media, he's continuously slandered. We don't know where those stories are coming from. And he has, he was a straight-A student and got a full scholarship while he was in Rikers for a year. People were calling him the next Khalif Browder, which has very frightening connotations, of course, as we all know. And now he's not been able to start his freshman year because he's still having to show up to court appearances.
Right, for things that he didn't do.
That he didn't
that he's
do.
Still fighting. He's just, he came out with bail, right? Like,
His bail was set at $250,000 for a charge, an attempted murder charge that then was changed mysteriously then because they didn't have the evidence to pin the weapon on him to mm-hmm. him being an accomplice. So they changed the story to then he handed the gun off to the person who then shot the weapon. And so there was a tremendous amount of exculpatory evidence that you know, when I saw all of it, I couldn't believe it at first. And you're always like, part of you is skeptical because you don't want to go in and just,
assume
right. uh-huh. From an advocacy standpoint that all of these young people are innocent and the policing is always at fault.
Right.
In fact, I check myself because I want to have a very healthy skepticism.
Mm-hmm.
But and frankly, that's why this project took so long. Because I wanted to make sure that we were not just putting another kind of piece of advocacy out into the world, that there's enough of that, that there has been a vitriolic relationship between anti-police and pro-law enforcement,
mm-hmm.
that you know, where both sides are out for vengeance. They want blood because there's so much hurt and anger from both sides. I wanted to tell the story that was weaving through all of that rhetoric and was actually just showing the experiences of cops on the beat who felt that they want to do better for the community but are being asked to do otherwise,
mm-hmm.
and then what the collateral damage of these harmful practices were, which was families being torn apart, young men being sent to prison, and, you know, just the full and complete economic, emotional, mm-hmm. spiritual tumult of being criminalized when all you're trying to do is make the most with what little you've been given.
What is that impacted you the most during the process, and what was your take overall?
I think what really moved me was that this, you know, this is just a story about people trying to do the right thing against mm-hmm. great odds. And, you know, it's something that we all want to try and believe about ourselves, that if we were put in a position where something very important had to be discussed and that you had very exclusive knowledge of that issue or problem or injustice, we all want to believe we would do the right thing. But, you know, the reality is very hard.
Mm-hmm.
And there's very little incentive to do the right thing sometimes. And so at the end of the day, I feel like what they're doing is such a great social service. It's because it's an act of defiance against their supervisors, the people who have, you know, written the policy and created the environment, and that tells them their survival is based on compliance.
Mm-hmm.
And we're willing to say no. And, you know, that's not an easy thing to do in this day and age, especially when we also happen to live in a moment where the truth is entirely malleable.
Right.
And the media is basically going to disseminate a narrative that is most forcefully put upon them. And so in New York City, that happens to often be a narrative mm-hmm. that is favorable to the city and often favorable to the department, depending on who's reporting on it.
What has been the reaction from the public?
I can't even describe to you the outpouring of emotion and in a way like thanks and relief. I mean, mm-hmm. I don't say that to, you know, compliment our film or anything, but it is just, I feel like we have struck a nerve by helping tell the story of these officers and families. And mm-hmm. it's a nerve that is very sensitive and is at the core of the minority experience in New York City, mm-hmm. particularly the Black and Latino experience. And so that response has been really inspiring. It's made me feel even more committed to this idea that we have to we have to follow through with a very robust social impact campaign. So we're trying to get this into many community centers, in educational environments, housing projects, prisons, jails, and of course, in front of city council. You know, we want the mayor to see this. We want people in positions to actually change the policy to look at this film. And, you know, what's heartening to me is that the president of the Sergeants Union, the president of the Sergeants Union said to me, nobody that is in the department can look at this film and truthfully say that this is just a bunch of bullshit.
Right.
Because everybody deep down will know when they see this that it is true. There's quotas, and there's also a lot of rampant corruption, and there's also retaliation against officers who don't comply with supervisors, and the supervisors are not always right. And so what we're trying to do is also demystify. These cops, some of them are still working on the job. They've blown the whistle. Of course, it's been very uncomfortable.
I can't even imagine their work environment after they're starting filming this movie once it was released. I mean, the documentary, it's probably pretty intense for them at this point.
Yeah, I mean, you know, they describe it. It's like on a good day, it's lonely, right? Because nobody's talking to them,
right?
Or most people want to avoid them, you know, because they're rats. You know, they're pariahs. They're the ones who sold out the department. You know, and people want to claim that this was for money or for fame or whatever. These guys did not get rich or famous over this. You know, they are still trying to struggle to make ends meet. And they're doing this because they know that what they've done is a rare act. And it is contributing to breaking down this culture of fear and silence within the department.
Right.
You know, we've mobilized outside as, you know, journalists or filmmakers or activists and organizers, you know, there is this idea of intersectionality, but that intersectionality has not been inclusive of progressively minded law enforcement who know, can speak with experience and knowledge, not with rhetorical statement, but with true firsthand evidence of what's happening in each city's department. And so we have to find those individuals and support them and show them that NYPD 12, they are still fighting the good fight, and they're around, and they're doing the work to try and reboot this conversation, because, you know, like at any given point nationally, there are, I saw a poll that said at most between 57% of the public believes that the police are going to protect them and that they are trustworthy. Only roughly half the public in this nation of 18,000 police departments trust the police. That is not the right number. I mean, this is, you know, supposed to be the most important institution to maintaining a civil society, and yet only half of our country believes that that's truly the mission and the impact.
It's because of all the cases that, you know, have been happening and everything that the community has been dealing with. Like, how can you trust a police department that it's targeting black and brown people? And, you know, when you see the difference between how they treat black and brown people and how they treat white folks, it's, you know, it's a big difference. So you see racism within the police department. When you see, when we talk about training, it's like, yeah, we can get down to training and, you know, add all these new policies, but how are you going to tell someone not to be racist?
And that starts with by identifying the structural bias that exists within the department's policy and practice. And so what we're trying to do is shift our perception, you know, of what we think the divide is. The divide is not between law enforcement and the community. The divide is between people who know what is harmful practice because they've been on the receiving end of that, which includes some law enforcement and the community and the department chiefs, policy writers, and people who are basically determining the culture and practice and expectations of rank and file officers. So, to shift this conversation, because for too long this has been about an antagonistic relationship.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like you see a cop who has been put on, you know, on a protest detail. And so every protester walks by and calls them an effing pig.
Mm-hmm.
Or if they happen to be a minority, they call them a traitor. Our cops, all of them, have been in the NYPD 12. They've all done protest detail. And, you know, they're the officers who are single-handedly doing the most in this city, in New York City, to try and address, expose, and change harmful practices. And yet they do protest detail and, you know, it's almost laughable because it's so hurtful that they're called, you know, dozens of times on, you know, racist, pigs, traitors, you know. And they just have to sort of, you know, bite their lip and just try and shrug it off because it's the uniform that is being
right
called those labels and those names.
Yeah.
But what we have to do is look past the uniform and see who are the individuals, you know, who are actually trying to